The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Real Recognition Radio, a program designed to promote a positive work environment. Your hosts are Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. In this hour, you will be motivated to motivate, increase morale, productivity, loyalty, and reduce turnover. Learn how some companies get it while others don't. Now, here are your hosts, Roy and Max.
Welcome to Real Recognition Radio, the show that's all about creating a better workplace and developing positive relationships where people can thrive. My name is Max Brown, along with my colleague Roy Saunderson today, and we're from the Recognition Management Institute. Roy, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I'm looking forward to our show today.
Well, I am delighted, and as you know, we have Dr. and Dr. Wendy and Dave Ulrich, authors of the new book that's just coming out called The Why of Work. Let me introduce them briefly and welcome them both to the show. Dr. Wendy Ulrich has been a practicing psychologist for over 20 years and is the author of two books. She's also the founder of 16 Stone Center for Growth in Utah, which offers seminar retreats on creating meaning in life. Dr. Dave Ulrich is a professor of business at the Ross School of Business and University of Michigan and co-founder of the RBL Group. He has written 23 books. Was named a top management thought leader in Business Week, Fortune, Financial Times, The Economist, and People Management, and serves on the board of directors for the Herman Miller and Board of Trustees for Southern Virginia University. Of course, you both do so many other things as well, but we are so grateful you would take the time and welcome you both to the show.
Delighted to be here, Max and Roy. Thank you for having us.
Amen.
We are grateful.
Very much so.
Yes, and if it weren't for the why of work, there's so many other reasons to talk with you today and your wealth of experience and knowledge, but let's get into the new book right from the beginning so that the audience can get to appreciate a little bit about what you're talking about. And I love the premise of why you wrote the book, which, if I might state the, or readdress the, restate the question, you asked, how do great leaders create, for themselves and for others, a sense of abundance that has meaning, purpose, hope, and pleasure, that not only engages employees, but also delivers value to customers, investors, and communities? My goodness, what a great question. Can you tell us what resulted from that?
Dave, I think that one's yours.
I think we were both going to pass to each other. We come at this with different lenses. Wendy works more as a psychologist, helping people go through the process of personal healing and personal growth. I tend to be more of an organizational, I don't know what the right word is, probably not a good one, but an organizational fix-it person who looks at organizations. But both of us I would consider us meaning junkies. We love to find meaning in our lives, and we look for meaning in the lives of those around us. And what we see in the world we live in is, and you both see it with your work on recognition, is just a deficit. Depression is high, engagement at work is low, in health and healthcare costs are going up, and mental health is a big cost. In the face of that deficit, people need to find a source of meaning and purpose. They can find it at home, and it's a great place with family and kids. We can find it in hobbies. We can find it in church groups. But one of the places we spend a great deal of our time is at work. And we believe that when leaders can build meaning in the work setting, they will not only help their employees feel not just committed, they're not engaged to the job, but they're finding passion and purpose in the job, but also their customers, their investors, their communities will get incredible benefits. And so making meaning makes money. And that's the premise we're looking at.
And how does it, let's take that a little further, because it does make money. And I'm curious, because it seems like there's a reluctance somehow, or maybe there's this emergence of people that are just learning this for some reason but haven't thought of it in the past. Can you elaborate a little bit more on how this makes money, and maybe even how does the why of work create more abundance as well?
Well, the constant concern, of course, of businesses is the bottom line, with good reason. If they don't worry about the bottom line, they don't survive. And in addition, of course, businesses today are huge entities in society, and many of our largest businesses have more revenue that they're dealing with than most of the world's countries have. So they are a powerful influence, and can be a powerful influence for good. As we look at bringing people out of poverty, it's more often businesses that have done that than charities or government organizations or other efforts by World Bank, and those kinds of things sometimes are not as effective as a big business will be. So businesses need to be financially successful and can actually do a lot of good, despite our cynicism about them, in being helpful to the world. But because many of the best business leaders are so focused on the bottom line, sometimes they don't realize that not all of their employees are as driven by that number as they are. And they can get the idea that the best way to get them driven by it is to just keep emphasizing it over and over and over again, that numbers are what it's all about. But that doesn't work for everybody. And in fact, most employees are, including great leaders, to be fair, are at work because they want to find meaning. They want to make a difference. They want to contribute something that will make the world a better place. They want to do things that use their strengths. They want to find happiness at work. They want to be at work because it means something to them, because it's valuable to them. And we find that the evidence really lines up to suggest that not only are people better off in terms of their personal well-being, but companies are better off when they invest in their people and when they help to work that agenda of helping people find meaning at work. The companies who do that best have good, long-sustained, long-term bottom-line results for that effort. And the most admired companies, the companies that people describe as the best place to work for, are actually companies that are more successful financially as well.
Absolutely. And Wendy, thank you for bringing up the idea that corporations can be such a great place for social change and impact as well, lifting up people around the world, as you mentioned. Huge, huge power in the world. In fact, we recently had a great conversation with Matthew Bishop, who wrote Philanthrocapitalism, similar to what you just said. You know, the corporations have huge potential for a great impact.
Definitely.
But you talked about this meaning that people want to have as well, which I just love. In the book, you actually suggest, put it this way, which I just love this quote, and I'd love if you could explain this for me some more. You said, what meaning means, why it matters, and how to develop it was a complicated task. So trying to come up with what meaning means and being the meaning junkies, as you referred to, Dave, as well, perhaps you could explain just a little bit more on what this means, either of you there.
Wendy, do you want to try that?
You know, there's a lot of ways of approaching that issue of meaning. We can look at it in terms of, you know, where do our brains light up and in what ways with different kinds of experiences that people have. One of the definitions that I liked looks at meaning as a connection. We find meaning when we make a connection of ideas. We find meaning when we make a connection with other people. We find meaning when we are connected with our own deepest values. And all of those kinds of connection actually have a physiological response in the brain that is associated with pleasure. And so we're sort of pre-wired as human beings to look for meaning, to look for connections, to look for the stories and the symbols and the ideas and the relationships that make our lives feel worthwhile and give us a sense of purpose.
I love that. And you mentioned that there's two parts to meaning, if you will, an inherent value and a market value that combine to create abundant organizations. Can you define that for us a bit more as well?
We describe an abundant organization as a place that gives meaning to individuals, where individuals find meaning, but that also gives value to customers and stakeholders and investors and brings hope to humanity at large. We think all three of those layers of meaning are extremely important if a company is going to be successful and if people are going to feel good about the contribution that they make through their work. They have to know that it's not only something that that is speaking to their personal values, but that it has value to other people, to the customers, to the investors, to the world. We don't find meaning in just sitting in our corners and thinking great thoughts for the most part. We find meaning when we make a difference. And part of that difference at an organizational level is when we're successful, when we're actually meeting the real needs of real people, of the customers and the stakeholders in our organization and the communities in which we operate.
How do you recommend that we institutionalize this abundance of meaning then without losing its value or coming off as a PR statement or as a gimmick?
That's where I love to play. I like organizations. If you look at a pizza parlor, for example, and you've interviewed people that have worked with them, you say, how do we continue to make money? And one of the predictions is that you make money by the people you hire. When you have people who are committed as employees, the customers who come in will be committed. In almost every retail chain, they've done an employee customer value proposition where stores that have a higher customer or a higher employee engagement index will also have a higher customer commitment index. And so the relationship is true. Now, how do you institutionalize it? Welcome HR. Everybody thinks human resources is boring and deadly. It is terrific. That's my world. You hire the right people. You train them the right way. You pay them the right way. You communicate the right way. We structure the organization the right way. In your work with recognition, you build recognition systems so that employees feel that they're being recognized not just for their economic contribution, but for their emotional one. And when that happens, meaning occurs for the employees. And when meaning occurs for the employees, it's likely to occur for the customers and for the investors.
Mm-hmm. But let me challenge this a little bit to say that it sounds like we need a new type of leader then, doesn't it? That one that goes to MBA school and learns more than just how to do accounting and finance, because what you're talking about now is this almost this emotional and personal investment in people.
Absolutely. The metaphor we love, and I'll just take a minute to explain it, about the change in leadership is a TV show. In 2004, the TV show came out called The Apprentice. I almost forgot it for a minute. We've all seen it. And it's a great entertainment, but it's lousy leadership. Because the premise of The Apprentice is that at the end of the show, every 24 contestants go through little games, and the winner stays on, and then every show, Mr. Trump or the owner, and it's different ones in Europe and Asia, says, you're fired, and I'm in charge, and you must do what I say. At the end of the show, there's one person left standing who's hired, and 23 losers. What a terrible leadership style. What a terrible leadership. And it's, in fact, I think it's that kind of leadership, arrogance, and hubris that got us into America in the recession, because we had leaders who distanced themselves from others. They sat behind their desk. They weren't connected to their employees. They weren't sensitive. Parallel that real quick with a show that came out January of 2010 at the end of the Super Bowl called Undercover Boss. In this show, the leader dressed down as an employee and went to discover what gives meaning to my employees. In one episode, the leader of 7-Eleven went to a 7-Eleven store and found a woman named Dolores. She's 65 years old, and she serves 2,500 cups of coffee a day, the highest coffee store in the entire 7-Eleven system. And the leader went in undercover and tried to find out why, and what it was she found meaning at work, because over the 18 years she'd worked there, she knew the names of almost every customer. And they didn't sell coffee. They had relationships. And so in The Undercover Boss, the boss comes back and says to 1,000 employees, not just one, but 1,000, I have discovered what gives you meaning. Mm-hmm. It's purpose at work. It's opportunities. It's relationships. It's identity. It's challenging work. And my job as your boss is to be a meaning maker. And 1,000 people stand up and applaud. The Apprentice. Wins the job and can now punish someone else. An Undercover Boss, 1,000 people stand up and applaud, are committed, dedicated, and more productive.
It's a different type of focus, isn't it? And I hope we can actually take that into this next segment here as well. We have to take a quick break, unfortunately, and this time goes very, very fast. But we're speaking today with Dr. Dave Ulrich and Dr. Wendy Ulrich, and you're listening to Real Recognition Radio on the Voice America Business Channel. Please come right back as we continue our conversation.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network. How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about. Getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio with myself, Roy Saunderson, and Max Brown. And our guests today, Dr. Dave Ulrich and Wendy Ulrich, authors of the forthcoming book, The Why of Work. And we're grateful to have you on the show, and I was excited to hear some of these comments. And I remember, Dave, you asked just before the show, what are we seeing as we talk to different people? What are we hearing with our ears to the ground? What people are talking about the workplaces today? And the commonality that I'm starting to pick up on is this word contribution. And just before the break, you were talking about that employees need to be recognized for their emotional contribution, not just financial. And we've defined real recognition as being appreciating people for who they are and recognizing people for what they do. And why do you think this contribution piece is becoming such a forefront need for today?
I'm not sure I can answer the need as well as Wendy, who comes with psychology, but let me tell you where I think it's showing up. In the late 1990s, there was a book done called The War for Talent. And the premise was, we win, you lose. And there's this bitter battle over talent. It's a great metaphor, and it's out of date. We think the talent war needs to change to what we call a Marshall Plan for talent. At the end of World War I, there was the Versailles Treaty, where the Allies punished the losers, and that caused, to some extent, World War II. At the end of World War II, there was a Marshall Plan, where we learned to work together. We find emotional and financial bonds between us. In the talent game, we see that happening. In the 90s, talent was focused on competence, right person, right place. In the last decade, it's been on commitment. Are you coming to work? Behavioral commitment. Are you showing up? Are you engaged? We love your word, contribution. We think that's the next wave of the talent game. Because you can have people who are smart, that's competent, they show up every day, that's committed, but they don't have their hearts and souls in the game. And the real recognition, the real agenda for organizations is, how do we get people's hearts and souls in the game so that they become sustainably productive?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, Max and Roy, what gives you a sense of contribution at work? What gives you a sense of purpose and direction in what you do?
Max, why don't you lead off there?
Wow, okay. Well, I'll tell you, having conversations like this just really get me excited, because I do believe that there's a lot of great work going on right now that is sharing wonderful, wonderful truths and principles that we can all be better by. And as you suggested, Dave, a moment ago with a book that is outdated, I do believe a lot of people have realized that the sense of greed of the past is no longer acceptable. So for me, my sense of purpose comes from being able to share this abundance with people. Being able to bring up and lift others up is, I get jazzed.
So when you really feel like the work that you're doing connects with deep values that you hold, it sounds like that really makes a difference for you, and
absolutely,
you get excited about what you do.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think that's true for most of us. When we feel like our values are in play, that the work that we do really is making a difference, not only to other people, but to our own sense of making a contribution and of having our own lives meaningfully engaged, our strengths engaged, the things that we care about engaged in what we do, we tend to work harder. We tend to be more enthusiastic about what we're doing. We tend to feel better about it. Now, as you've pointed out, this can all be a you know, one more PR effort within the company to just get people to work more and use them up a little faster. And if it ends up being that way, people will quickly see through that. We're not idiots, you know, and we'll figure out pretty fast if corporate is just trying to use us and to sort of bribe us into working harder by pretending that they care about us. But if leaders are really genuine about recognizing that people do their best work when their strengths are engaged, when their values are engaged, when their hearts and souls are in the game, they can really gain enormous loyalty, enormous contribution from the people that are working with them on those projects.
Now, I know that you've mentioned in your book that obviously companies have to be focused on profits, and that's often been a measure of success for them. And it is a tremendous benefit when employees find meaning. And you stated that when you wrote, there's a strong business case for helping people find meaning at work. As employees find meaning, they contribute to the broadest purposes for which organizations exist, creating value for customers, investors, and communities. So to both of you, and I don't know which one's going to take this on, but how can organizations really help employees find meaning?
Let me start with that, and Wendy will go on. We've all said today that there seems to be in many disciplines people looking at how do you find meaning in our personal lives. Wendy and I wanted to combine that from the psychology point of view and the organizational view and bring it into an organization. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to then say, so what do leaders do that create meaning? I am absolutely assured we don't have it right, but we pick 7 disciplines, and we'll do some very quickly. Each discipline gives me a lens or a tip as to what a leader can do. The first is out of positive psychology. Focus on your strengths and what you're good at so that people have an identity. Leaders, what are people good at? Max and Roy, you're very good at building a positive environment. You're very good at engaging others. When we focus on those strengths and encourage those strengths in your work, you'll be able to find more meaning in what you do. Number 2, have a purpose. A compelling purpose pulls us forward to a great future. It gives us a sense of identity. And the purposes also differ. I was in a company 3 days ago, and it's a company that's done a turnaround. I don't want to name it. It's a privately held company. They've grown very rapidly and the chairman or the head of the company stood up and he said, ladies and gentlemen, to his top 200, 150 people, I'm so excited. Our EBITDA, earnings before income depreciation and taxes, has gone from 230 to 305, and I'm thrilled. And you know what he is? Because the numbers work for him. But I looked around the room. There are a whole bunch of people who were thinking, we're glad you're rich. What does this mean to me? And so I stood up and I said, we got to change the definition of EBITDA. It's everybody improves through dedicated appreciation. And he said, oh, you mean it's not just the numbers? And I said, that works for some. But our purpose has got to be, what's the purpose that works for you?
Wow.
Boy, we got 7 of these, and we won't bore you with all of them. But those are the kinds of, and what was fascinating, he wrote me a note last night, and he said, thank you for the session. He said, I've been so worried, and this is legitimate, about getting us to make our financials, which are legitimate and true. He said, I think I've missed a little bit our people. I've wanted quality. I've wanted operational excellence. I've wanted customer solutions. The fourth leg of that stool needs to be employee heart and soul. Yeah. And he said, my people told me after you left that if we could bring that one in, the others will be sustainable.
So how do you help a leader like that become what you've described in your book as meaning makers?
I think one of the keys is to not try to fight against what that leader's personal values might be. This individual was very driven by the numbers. It was really meaningful to him. It was how he measured his success. It was how he felt good about what he was doing. And some of that was his personal predisposition. Some of that was the numbers, you know, were going to make him personally wealthy. But some of it was he loved the numbers. He loved playing with that part of life. And so that was very meaningful to him. And rather than trying to fight against that and say numbers aren't what matter, because they do to him, to simply point out, you know, for you personally, this really works. But for a lot of people in your organization, they are driven by many other things. And if you can find what drives and motivates and gives purpose and meaning and value to each person in the organization, even though it may not be for them the same thing that it is for you, they can have the same passion, the same enthusiasm, the same delight in what they're doing as you have when the numbers are going well. So if we can help them realize that there's nothing wrong with their motivation, it just may not be everybody's motivation. And and finding each individual's high motivating values and goals and skills and characteristics and relationships will help them to be as excited about the work as the people are who are excited about the numbers are when they get what they want.
And, you know, it's almost like we've accommodated the CEOs by giving them the numbers, but there's only one of them. And yet they haven't kind of spoken the language of the employees.
Nice point. Nice point.
Yeah, and unfortunately, one of the things that happens is it becomes sort of this tug of war of people feeling like, well, you either make people happy or you make the company rich. And
yes.
We really don't believe that the statistics and the data support that. It looks like that's a false dichotomy that we've created. And we see that over the long term, when the numbers are strong, but when people are also engaged and excited about what they're doing, their creative urges are unleashed, their relationships are supported, there's a positive environment in the emotional feel of the workplace, those things actually contribute to the numbers, even though numbers may not be the thing that everybody's completely motivated by.
Hmm. Wow. We've got 1 minute before our next break, and maybe I could ask one quick answer then to this question, which is, why do leaders not get it?
Dave, I think that was yours.
In 1 minute, why do leaders not get it? They don't see the connection between their actions and the impact of their actions. We judge ourselves by our intent, and others judge us by our behavior. And I think sometimes leaders have great intents, but they don't see the things that will help other people get to their intent. We assume other people have our same intent. This leader assumed everybody had the same commitment to numbers that he did.
Yeah.
By the way, people are happy to make the numbers, but if you can do it in a way that works for them, it will be sustainable.
So it's almost giving meaning to numbers.
Yeah, yeah. And I love what Wendy said, that we create a false dichotomy. I've been
yes.
in some places, they said, so do you want profits or do you want to care about people? And the answer
uh-huh.
is yes. Yes. And why do they have to be separate? Why do they
yeah.
have to be separate?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I love it because what you're talking about, it's not just the bottom line. It's above the bottom line. And we've got to measure a lot more things than just those profits alone. That's great. Well, listen, this has been a very fast-flowing conversation with the two of you, and we're going to have to take another break. So join us back in a few minutes on Real Recognition Radio as we ask our guests, Dr. Dave and Wendy Ulrich, more about creating meaningful work and workplaces. For Real Recognition Radio, this is Roy Saunderson and Max Brown.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now. Toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and myself, Max Brown, and our guest today, Dr. and Dr. Wendy and Dave Ulrich, the authors of The Why of Work. as we've talked a lot about the challenges, and we just finished talking about those challenges, Dave and Wendy both, I appreciated both your comments around why people haven't seen it in the past or what their biggest challenges are, that they forget that other people might find meaning from somewhere else. I want to take a little bit of a change now for a moment and ask, where does deficit-laden thinking begin? Because it seems like not only do we sometimes forget the meaning for others, but it sounds like ego-driven issues are also a big issue here. Am I correct on that?
I think that's definitely true, and it's an interesting thing to think about. How do we learn to find meaning in life, meaning in relationships, meaning in work? And we learn it from other people. Sometimes when we just assume that this is something everybody knows how to do, but this is actually a skill that people have to learn. We learn it from people around us who've taught us how to have a good time at work, who've taught us how to get through a boring day, who've taught us how to to make a joke about something and make it funny when it could be just feeling disastrous. We actually learn how to find meaning in our lives by watching other people who do it well. Mm-hmm. And maybe they aren't explicit that, oh, I'm teaching you how to find meaning or how to make meaning, but matter of fact, they probably aren't. It would probably sound kind of weird if somebody said that, but we learn it when other people around us are skilled at it. But a lot of us today have gotten the idea that what makes meaning in our life is our actual circumstances, the place that we live, whether it's sunny out today or not, whether we're bored or whether we're excited about what we happen to be doing today. We get the idea that it's the circumstances around us that make our life positive or negative. But I've learned as a psychologist that people come in with all kinds of different circumstances in their lives, and it's not the circumstances themselves that make people depressed or anxious or happy or positive, but it's what they tell themselves those circumstances mean about them. Now, that's not to say there aren't, you know, physiological things that go wrong in people's lives sometimes that also contribute to anxiety or depression or other things, but many times it's not what our circumstances are that cause us to feel one way or another, but what we tell ourselves those circumstances mean. And a lot of us go to work and tell ourselves, I hate my job, I'm never going to be happy as long as this is what's going on, I can't really do what I love here. Some of finding abundance at work is certainly finding what we're passionate about and trying to find a job where we get to do what we love. But some of it is also looking at whatever job we're in and figuring out what the skills are for finding enjoyment and satisfaction in that job, even if it's not the favorite thing that we would pick right off the bat.
Mm-hmm. And Wendy, well, there is some personal responsibility there, obviously, and I appreciate what you said, particularly around, you know, how we make meaning or to the circumstances as they hit us. Is there a responsibility for the leader, though, and how they have a tremendous influence? You know, some of these toxic workplaces dictated by a toxic boss, and how does that impact those who might want to engage more but just don't feel like they can?
I think leaders have an enormous responsibility, and I think we have to come back to the issue. They have an enormous responsibility to their investors, their stakeholders, and their customers. All of those people are hurt when leaders do not take seriously the agenda of helping their employees find meaning at work. So it's not just that they hold a responsibility to, you know, to be nice to people, although I think they do. They also hold a responsibility to the stakeholders and the investors who are counting on them to do their best by their company. If we're, as leaders, if we're not doing our best by our employees to help engage their creativity and their passion for what they're doing, we are not only hurting them, but we're hurting our bottom line.
Oh, that's interesting because, you know, we look at the past and how some leaders have dictated financial performance, regardless, and really browbeat people. I think it came from that Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And yet now we're talking about this new meaning, as you share in this book. And you actually have a table in the book that I really liked, declaring, like, leadership arrogance and the decline, the steady decline. And then you contrast that with humility and prosperity. Can you describe that?
Let me address that one.
Why is leadership humility so important?
Let me address it with specifics, but let me go back to the question you just raised and give an example. A few months ago, I had a great opportunity. I was in India, and I met the prime minister of a little country called Bhutan. Mm-hmm. I've heard of Bhutan, but I didn't know much about it. It's a small country between China and Russia of about 800,000 people. In 1972, the king of Bhutan said, Most countries judge themselves by gross domestic product. The equivalent that you and Wendy just talked about was, how economically well off are we? Are we moving up? Are we moving up in bigger houses, bigger cars? And he said, that just feels wrong. And so he created a gross happiness index. And in the last 30 years, every country in the world is tracked by their gross happiness. Bhutan, one of the poorest economic countries in the world, is have been consistently in the top 10 of happiness, or a book that just came out, well-being. I think the same is true in people. It isn't the economics, it's the well-being. And the same is true in organizations. It isn't just the economics, it's the well-being or happiness or connection within people. Now, what does that mean around prosperity and arrogance? 2 years ago, I was in Singapore with a group of senior leaders in the country, some of which were religious leaders, government leaders, and business leaders, and they said, Professor Owers, from your point of view, why did this recession happen? And I'm going, oh my goodness, what am I going to say to that? I'm supposed to be profound. I'm not an economist. I'm not a banker. I don't want to go into the collateralized loans and unsecured debt. And I said, I think it from an organization point of view. Here's the premise. Prosperity is a very high obligation and risk. Prosperity often comes because leaders have a sense of humility. They're curious, they ask questions, they connect with customers, and sometimes the humility goes across the prosperity, and with prosperity comes arrogance. Pride precedeth the fall. And with arrogance or hubris, the leaders distance themselves from their employees, they distance themselves from their customers. They have answers, not questions. They look at how good they are, not how good they need to become. And suddenly they get locked into an isolated place and start making very bad decisions. They don't adjust. They don't learn. One of the cycles of failure that great books have looked at is when people become prideful, their pride often leads them into very bad decisions with arrogance and hubris. And what leaders need to do is maintain a sense of humility, a sense of making meaning for themselves and others. And we think that's one of the criteria of success, that it's not how successful I am, it's how successful I help others become.
That's a huge statement. I wonder how many of the leaders, can you give us an example of a leader who actually believes that for them, for their people as well?
You bet. I was just doing some work in a company called John Deere. They make farm equipment, manufacturing equipment, and they've had incredible financial success, even in tough economics. They have a new president. He's wonderful. His name is Sam. And he stood up recently in a meeting a few months ago, and he said to his employees, the future, well, congratulations. This is one of our best years ever. Let's celebrate. Let's be proud. But let's look forward. Let's recognize we have a long way to go. The population of the world will double in the next 30 years. The land available for farming will stay at 15%. Ladies and gentlemen of John Deere, with all humility and all desire, how do we double the productivity of that land? If we can't do that and contribute to that, the world won't eat well. That's our mission. That's our vision. And let's not get arrogant about our past, which has been very successful, but let's get inquisitive about creating our future.
No, one of the questions that's going to be coming up is going to be, how do executives get engaged with this whole concept, which we certainly agree and support, of the meaning of work? How do we get them really connected to this?
We're not asking them to do something that's just going to cost them money with no results on the other end, but we're actually looking at helping them to make the very best use of the best resource they have, which is the people that work for them. In any company, it's the people that make the difference between a success and a failure. It's the technology, certainly. It's the finances, certainly. But it's the people behind those technologies and finances, the people who implement them, who innovate them, who track them, who give their best effort to making all of that work. And in the organizational development of the whole group, that is really the hidden success in any company. And so as we help them realize that they will make their best use of their best people and of everyone in their organization as they help people find meaning, I think that we can begin to create the business case for this being something that leaders would not be responsible as leaders if they're not paying attention. Not just responsible to the people, but responsible to their own bottom line.
Just more. It sounds like a more holistic view. It sounds like there's a whole lot more we need to be aware of, as opposed to just the profit-driven past. And then it's time to move on.
Absolutely. You know, one of the statistics that when we're training and teaching people about this, that is kind of an interesting one to look at, is some research by the Gallup folks. They looked at some issues around well-being at work, and they found, for just a simple example on one of the 7 points that we make about how we can create meaning, that if there were one single factor in place for every employee in the company, that their statistics indicate that it would create a 7-fold increase in the number of people in that company who are highly satisfied with their work. Mm-hmm. It would double the number of people who say they are highly satisfied with their pay. It would triple the number of people who are satisfied with pay at the lowest echelons of the pay scale. It increases... It reduces absenteeism. It increases creativity. It reduces accidents at work. All of those things are accomplished by one simple factor, and that is if people say they have a best friend at work. Relationships are something that not only are a nice to have, but if they are actually producing better customer satisfaction, fewer complaints, less absenteeism, fewer accidents, more people who are highly satisfied with their work setting. All of those are things that are not only valuable to human beings, but are valuable for many, many aspects of a company's success. And yet, how many companies actually invest in teaching people relationship skills, in helping them have time and opportunity to make and keep good friends at work? This has been one of those things that most companies simply do not pay attention to, don't think about as being a genuine advantage that they can bring to their employees that will help their work to go better. But as companies become aware that this is the kind of thing that really makes a difference in how employees respond at work and how often they show up and how well they take advantage of their training programs, all of those kinds of things, then we can begin to ask questions like, well, what can we do about this? How can we make sure that our employees have the skills to make good friendships, that they have the time to make good friendships at work, that we don't disrupt their lives so much that their friendships are always undermined and thrown under the bus as we're trying to work on making work for people. I can tell you guys have a great friendship, and it makes all the difference in the world when we go to work and we like the people that we're working with. So the biggest reason that people move when they leave their companies is because they're not getting along with their manager. So when we help people to learn how to resolve conflict, how to invest in relationships, how to apologize to each other when things don't go well, all of those things actually are helping not only people have a better experience, but the bottom line results of the company.
And, you know, as I've been looking through your book and as we've had this conversation, one of the things I know I can see employees struggling with is answering some of the many wonderful, thought-provoking questions you have in your book, such as, what will I be known for? What impact do I want to make, in the workplace? How have you found from your research that people get around this discomfort, this newness of thinking and answering these kinds of questions?
Well, it's a great question, and you're right. There are some people who kind of look at a question like that and don't quite know where to begin. But I think when we can begin to have dialogues about these things, when we begin to make room for people to discuss these questions, it's not that they're impossible questions for us to answer. It's just that we need a little time to think about them, and sometimes a little encouragement from hearing other people's answers and beginning to resonate with the things that we find in common or recognizing that we have a different response. So when we ask these questions in groups, we sometimes get kind of blank stares from people at the beginning. But
yes,
as we begin to give people permission to think about such things, as there's a trust level built up, as a leader models some of the ways that they think about these questions in their life, as they model the fact that, yeah, these aren't questions that we're used to asking each other. These aren't questions we're necessarily used to thinking about very much. But let me sort of show you or tell you or share with you how I've begun to think about this question in my own life. We can build a place where it's safe to think about these things, where there's time to think about them, and I think in the process deepen the conversation and deepen the understanding of what it means to be a good employee, what it means to be happy at work, as we open up these doors and help people to walk through them.
So in many ways, it's going deeper into work rather than that superficial, you know, employee-employer contract perspective.
Definitely. I'm remembering a conversation we've gotten so that we kind of like to ask people in strange places and at strange times what they like about their work. And we talked to a couple of women who were working one day at a rental car agency when we were renting a car. There were two women. One was helping someone else, an older woman, and there was a young woman there, and she was trying to help us. And I just casually asked her, you know, what do you like about your work? And she looked at me sort of blankly for a moment, and she said, well, sometimes it's not very busy, and I can watch my soap opera behind the counter here because there's nobody around. And that was what she liked about her job, was that it gave her free time to watch the television.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of predicted that this was a young woman who wasn't going to last very long at this job,
mm-hmm.
just because of the way, not only the way she approached her job, but the way that she was approaching us, her customers.
Yeah, okay.
She was sort of perfunctory. You could tell she just wanted to get us off of her plate so that she could get back to something else. The other woman, when we asked her, because we got her attention a little further into this transaction, asked her what she liked about her job, and she said, oh, I just really enjoy the people. I really enjoy the opportunity to just be helpful to people and have conversations with people. And she'd obviously been at this job a long time. She knew exactly how to tell us how to get to the car. There were directions that were intuitive for us, not just from where she was standing. She gave us immediately wanted to know if we needed a map, was asking us for where we were headed and what we were going to be doing. Was clearly looked at my husband and said, you know, you're a big guy. I think this car that you're looking at isn't going to work for you very well. Let me suggest a different one. She was engaged in not only finding time to watch a television show, but in actually enjoying what she did and enjoying meeting our needs and helping us and having the response from us, which was our appreciation and our enjoyment of her. And obviously this was somebody who was very good at what she did and was going to last at it for a long time.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Now, it is wonderful to hear those kind of examples. It's a good contrast. And in your book, you certainly present both stories and statistics that show and talk about the deficit that many people face in their personal and professional lives. How do we help employees who can feel trapped get out of that kind of deficit thinking kind of culture of an organization?
I think the model that I've sort of looked at as we were writing this book and that's been very meaningful to me personally is the story of Viktor Frankl, a psychologist who is sort of the father of the issue of finding meaning. And it's been very interesting to me that he wrote his book, Man's Search for Meaning, and developed his theory of healing as a psychologist around meaning, coming out of his experience in a concentration camp in World War II, it would be hard to imagine a more deficit-oriented work environment than
Correct.
A concentration camp. And it was a work environment. They were expected to work, but work under starvation conditions for a regime that they didn't believe in, that was extraordinarily oppressive to them. People dying all around them. You think about the worst work environment you've ever worked in, nothing that we've experienced probably comes close to that. And yet in the midst of that, he was able to find meaning in his work, in the relationships that he had with other people, and trying to help and support his fellow prisoners there in looking at the values that were most important to him and the work that he was trying to accomplish as a psychologist that he hoped to return to one day in the wife that he hoped he would meet up with again, that was counting on him to live his life from his own deepest values. That's a very inspiring story to me that reminds me, and I hope reminds all of us in our work settings, that we don't have to be in optimal conditions to ask the questions, what would make my life more meaningful here? How can I respond to what is real here, not just what would be nice to have, but what really is, but respond to it from my deepest values so that I look back on this period of my life and say, this is what I learned. This is what I feel best about how I dealt with this circumstance, whatever it was that was dealt to me.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, as leaders listening to the show today, listen to all of this, it can sound like a lot of work to be able to find meaning and sustain this purpose kind of driven work life. What would you suggest leaders do as a first step in improving the workplace environment and the people themselves?
I'll take that. The first step, I think, is recognizing that sustainable profits come from sustainable people and productivity, and that comes from meaning. And just get that mindset. Second is, a simple first step is to stop and listen to your employees. Almost every company you know says people are our most important asset. It's become a truism. Get behind that and say, you know, to the employees, what's going on in your life? What is affecting your well-being? How can we make collectively this work environment a better place? We're not going to walk away from the performance. We will not walk away from that. That's a given. But how do we organize ourselves so that we can make that happen in a way that is meaningful to you? That might be a focus group. That might be a luncheon. That might be a casual managing by wandering around. There's a great book that's out by a woman named Liz Wiseman. It will be out this summer. And she calls it the multiplier effect. She said, sometimes when an employee meets with a leader, they leave feeling diminished. They leave feeling less good about themselves. The best leaders are multipliers. When anyone leaves a leader, they feel better about themselves. And I think when I've coached leaders to help become more meaning makers, it's to say, when you go out and talk to people and have a focus group or a luncheon or casually listen, make sure that you leave those employees feeling better about who they are.
Yeah.
Recognition is a key factor. You know that. That's your business. Getting them in the right job, giving them a work environment that's affirming. We call it a positive work culture, positive work environment. Giving them jobs that they love, that are easy, energizing, and enjoyable. Helping them learn. When they make a mistake, the issue is not to punish. The issue is to learn and to grow and to get better, to be resilient. And then to simply have fun at work. One leader we found in a company that had no budget for anything because of the economic decline, the night before, the leader and spouse, happened to be his wife, made peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and cookies, and they brought them to work for the meeting the next day. And at the break, when there was no other food, they said, we know it's not fancy, it's not what the hotel would serve, it's not great chocolate chip cookies, but we got some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and we got some and milk. We hope you like it. And by the way, those employees are delighted. They're saying, this leader is listening to me. They're trying to attend to me. And that's what we'd hope leaders can do.
Absolutely. That's wonderful ideas. And before we conclude our show today, if our listeners want to be able to find out more information about your great work on your work on the why of meaning of work, where can they find out more information about you?
Very easy. The title of the book is The Why of Work, and the website is the same, thewhyofwork.com. If you're interested, the book is coming out in about one more week. It'll be hitting the shelves. Pre-orders can be easily accessed at the website, which is thewhyofwork.com, and it's available at all the major internet booksellers, and we'd be delighted to share it with anyone who's interested.
That's wonderful. Well, we've certainly enjoyed reading the book, and I guess in the closing minutes that we have here, from each of you, any kind of surprises from your research and that you would like to share, kind of one kind of thought each.
You know, one of the things that has been very helpful to me is just recognizing the tremendous opportunity and impact for good that major corporations can have. It's easy to get cynical about business, but bureaucracies are actually the most effective human organizational form that we've invented yet for accomplishing a lot of work in an efficient way and distributing a lot of goods to a lot of people as effectively and efficiently as anyone has ever figured out to do it in the history of mankind. So for all of the drawbacks of bureaucracies and big corporations and business and all of those kinds of things and all of the negative stuff that occasionally happens, sometimes more often than we'd like, with greed and poor management and problems that come up, businesses are still the most effective and most the best opportunity that most of us have for having a better lifestyle, for having goods and opportunities that and opportunities to get out of poverty in a way that we have never had before. So we need to maximize the privilege that we have of working in settings where good things can happen, and we need to not only make sure that those companies are successful, but that they're doing the best that they can for humanity at large.
Certainly.
David. Mine would be very simple. In addition, making meaning makes money.
Mm-hmm.
We've said it over and over in this wonderful interview. This is not going back to the 60s and 70s and singing Kumbaya and bring a parrot to work.
Right.
Work is work. It is demanding, and it has a set of customer and investor expectations. We should run into those. Sometimes when there's conflict, we run and hide. We should run right into it, face it, and bring the meaning that we bring to that in order to go forward.
Well,
somebody also told me the other day, they said, Dave, I've read a lot of your books. This one reads well. And that's a thanks to Wendy. But it's we hope that we're part of a broader movement, that there's a lot of people trying to figure out how do we make the work setting the universal place to meet this universal need. And that's what we hope we can begin to find.
Well, we certainly hope that this show will help contribute to that, and we encourage our visitors and listeners, rather, to the show to go to thewhyofwork.com and to certainly purchase this great book that's going to give more meaning to work, the workplace, and to life in general. Thank you, Dave and Wendy, for joining us on our show today.
Absolutely.
Thank you. It's been such a delight to visit and appreciate the opportunity.
We've sure enjoyed it, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, Max and I welcome and encourage our listeners to send in their comments and any suggestions for further guests and shows that they would like to see us address. Please email us at feedback@realrecognition.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening to Real Recognition Radio. For more information about the Recognition Management Institute, you can visit us at realrecognition.com. Until next time, this is Roy Saunderson and Max Brown reminding you to keep it real.
Thank you again for tuning in Real Recognition Radio. Please join Roy Saunderson and Max Brown again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. For more motivational tips to help your employees perform better, we'll talk again next week.